Support for WBFO and What's Next comes from our members and from Health Foundation for Western and Central New York, where racial and socioeconomic health equity are prioritized. Learn more about building healthier neighborhoods at hfwcny.org.
I'm Jay Moran.
I'm Bridget Jaipal Valenza.
I'm Thomas O'Neill White.
We need to get together and let our voices be heard.
This is What's Next, a dedicated hour to have important conversations about the issues facing the marginalized and underrepresented communities of Western New York and Southern Ontario.
If we're going to have some real healing, we've got to have space to tell some uncomfortable truth.
What's Next continues our mission to discuss race,
equity,
and the common concerns of Buffalo's East Side and beyond.
In the suburban area, everywhere, we must work and teach our children.
And good morning. Welcome to What's Next. Today, we're going to continue our discussions regarding Project 2025. We'll get into a little bit about what Project 2025 is, if you're just kind of joining this conversation. It has been, of course, a big topic throughout the election season for sure, but yet in some ways not all that well known. With us to talk more about it, two members of the Clementine Gold Group with us, Akua Menzedu, who is the president and founder.
Yes.
Thanks for being with us, Akua. Yeah. And also with us, Kim Lavera, the managing director. Hi.
Good morning.
Thanks for being with us. And of course, first of all, I'll just kind of remind people or just kind of outline Project 2025, about a 900-page report that all talks about the transition of a conservative presidency in 2025 and outline some, I don't think it's wrong to say, extreme approaches to federal government. Just also to point out that the Trump-Vance administration or ticket has somewhat distanced themselves from this, but yet they most certainly have embraced certain policies inside Project 2025. What we want to get into, though, with the Clementine Gold Group, because your mission, unique set of skills and experience in equity, inclusion, consensus building, and engagement practices, DEI would be another way of describing it.
Yeah.
And DEI is woven throughout Project 25, and at least to say, not exactly embracing DEI, right?
Right.
What? Tell me about what you've been hearing about it, what you've been seeing about Project 2025.
Yeah, I think you're exactly right that this is an extreme set of measures that set to really attack it from a policy standpoint as it relates to DEI. In general, we know that DEI is under attack in this country. There's a lot of folks that are co-opting words and really making it mean something that's completely different than what it was intended to be. And so in the Project 2025 framework, it really is highlighting a lot of different ways that it aims to attack it from a federal level. I mean, in general, they're looking to get rid of a lot of these terms and, connection to the work that's being done at the federal level and rolling that back. And so we see it as a measure that, we need to get the word out around how this is really going to be detrimental to everyone, right? When we think about DEI, it's not just a certain set of folks that get to benefit from it. It really is laying the groundwork for everyone to benefit from DEI efforts.
And it's interesting how you mentioned co-opting of words and terms that are associated with DEI. And this might be a great way just to kind of start our conversation, and then we kind of move into some of the, or kind of interweave, weave that into, what is involved in Project 2025. But when you say terms that are being co-opted, what are you talking about?
I mean, DEI in general, right? And so we're seeing different terms that are being used, like didn't earn it, right? That's one of the biggest things that we're hearing as it relates to DEI. Anything come to mind for you, Kim?
I mean, I think that there are a lot of terms that are used for DEI at this point, right? Like whether you think someone is a DEI hire, we have a DEI card that gives us some sort of benefit at this point.
Woke
being sort of weaponized.
Right.
It's problematic. And I think, when you really break down DEI, from sort of this abstract high level term into more tangible actions or sort of the stories around it, it's much easier to embrace. When you think about things like, is it everyone having, a safe place to live or, having access to a job that pays a fair wage or you know, your children having access to, you know, equal play at recess. You know, I think that people can get behind things right. like that. But when you sort of make it this abstract concept and you weaponize it, mm-hmm. it seems as though, and you make it exclusionary, it seems as though there are folks that don't benefit. So, you know, ultimately there is some bumping.
Sure. Yeah.
You know, and you talk about your work also when it comes to DEI, mm-hmm. The benefits of it, because, you know, like you said, I mean, you've both touched on a couple of the terms that are not really all that nicely stated, for sure.
Right.
But there's more to it than just, you know, making sure that, like you said, you want to make sure everybody's treated equitably. Basically, yeah. that's what it comes down to. But beyond that, though, there is a lot of education that's going on for a society, it seems to me, mm-hmm. that there's been that there's parts of their education that have been shut off or just ignored for generations.
Right. Right. I think one of the biggest things, you know, as it relates to teaching folks about DEI is exactly, you know, who benefits. And we look at it from everyone benefiting. The curb cut effect is something that we often teach in our sessions around DEI. And the curb cut comes from the American Disability Act. Right. And so it's stated that we're putting these cuts in the curb so that folks that have disabilities can access the curb in a way that is beneficial to them. Right. But what they found was that by doing that curb cut, everyone then benefits. So if you're pushing a stroller, if you're, you know, carrying a dolly, if you're, you know, carrying luggage like I often do, you know, to get on the sidewalk, everyone is now benefiting. And so we like to frame it from this, you know, idea that it's not just benefiting a certain subset of people. It's really benefiting everyone. Right. And so what do you think, Kim?
Right. And I think there are curb cuts that you can look at in a lot of different areas that I think people don't
using
really
it as a metaphor.
Consider.
Right.
Yeah,
exactly.
Right. You know, because curb cut effect sort of becomes this umbrella term mm-hmm. that means, you know, something that you've done for a particular population that benefits everyone. You know, I always say things like Netflix captions, you know, who doesn't enjoy, you know, being able to see the captions? They obviously are made for a particular group, but we all benefit from them. Mm-hmm. You know, having different ergonomic furniture, Target Drive Up is technically
one of her faves.
and, you know, I mean, you guys are considerably younger than I am, but I can remember when the ADA passed, and I can remember the onslaught of reaction against it. Before it even became law, that this is going to drive businesses out, it's going to do this, that, and the other thing. And here we are now, 30 years later, I think more than 30 years later, and it is something that is totally embraced in society.
Yeah.
So you would say, as someone who is DEI, your business is about DEI, that 20 years from now, if we could stay this course and making sure that there is diversity, equity, and inclusion, a discussion going on in all facets of society, that we'd be a better place.
Absolutely, right? Without a doubt. And I think that's the biggest thing about all of this. We are seeing studies that say when you start to break this down, so you take this from this abstract level of, you know, a word and break it down into nuances for everyday folks, they embrace it, right? And that's what we try to do as practitioners in this space. Is take it from this abstract word into your everyday practice within organizations, right? And so when you talk about pay equity and people getting paid fairly, a living wage for the work that they're doing, not many people are going to say, no, you don't need that, right? Like you're going to embrace that. And so when you start to say, you know, if you are having a child and you have a pregnancy leave or, you know, paternal leave afterwards, no one's going to really say that that's not a good thing, right? And so I think that's the biggest thing about all of this work is taking it from this word that's now being co-opted and used as a scary term to saying, hey, everyone is benefiting, right? And this is something that we can all get behind for sure.
I'm wondering in your work, when you're going out to whether it's companies or other organizations, do you see maybe inside these discussions, do you get pushback from people who might be coming from that angle for lack of a better term, we'll just call it the Project 25 angle, looking for kind of these nuances of things to push back upon and somehow make it into a different discussion than it's meant to be?
You know, I don't, you, I see you have some ideas already.
Well, I think it comes up sometimes.
Okay.
Yeah.
I'm curious how it does, though, and what you sense for it, and maybe how you might overcome it, but mm-hmm. continue. I'm sorry for
I think some of it is, you know, just sort of fear mm-hmm. or not necessarily understanding what, you know, we're trying to implement, or a little bit more around like fear of losing like their status quo within their organization.
Yeah.
You know, they've been at a certain level, they've enjoyed certain privileges. And, you know, if someone else is able to come in, does that mean I lose all of those privileges?
Right.
And we try to make a point that we're just expanding benefits for others. It's not about taking something away from someone else.
Is that a common concern?
I think so, right? Like there's, you know, Kim mentioning this fear, I think there's a lot of fear-based conversations that are had around this. And so what does that mean if others have the opportunity to now grow within an organization and you know, really implement things and ideas that they might have? And so I would say in some of the trainings, you know, there's folks that are quiet and you can tell, right? Like there's something that's going on there and you're not quite sure. They're not really participating in the conversation. And I think the reactions that we hear is like, you know, some folks might not know where they fit in this conversation. And so if you're talking about DEI and it's been this term that's been used to say, oh, these certain people, whether it's sexual orientation, gender, race, are supposed to be benefiting from the conversation, then me as this straight white man might not have a place in this. And we are, you know, saying, no, you do, right? Mm-hmm. This is something that is also going to benefit you. When we think about organizations that have diversity at the helm, they're more successful. We're seeing more innovative ideas that are coming because you get to challenge each other and talk about your own lived experience that might make something better, right? Like when we think about equitable decision making, it's making sure that everyone has an opportunity to contribute. And these are the things that we are operationalizing within organizations, right? It's the way that you do work, inclusive working agreements. How are you going to handle conflict when it arises, right? And we know that folks coming from different cultures approach these things in a different way. So how do we make sure that the table is set in which everyone can contribute and challenge the idea to make it a lot better?
Right. And from these inclusive working agreements and, you know, these new sort of cross collaborative groups, mm-hmm. things mm-hmm. like that, we're seeing increased profit margins
exactly.
for a lot of organizations at a time where, you know, when you think about inflation and all of these things, you know, increased profits and bottom lines and, you know, potential benefits for your employees mm-hmm. is a great benefit.
Absolutely.
And so you are seeing or hearing from some of the organizations that you're working from that it's the DEI training is achieving more than just, and I don't want to say than just, mm-hmm. but than helping kind of everybody understand each other a little bit better.
Yeah.
But they're actually seeing bottom line.
Oh, yeah.
Success.
Yeah, absolutely.
For those that really embrace it, for sure.
Right. And so I think one example that I can think of, there's an organization we were working with, and they were looking at diversifying their workforce because it was predominantly white, you know, and they were trying to get into certain areas within the community that they weren't reflecting.
Mm.
And so that was one of the things that we work with them on is, you know, the whole process around hiring. What did that look like? We found that there were a lot of discrepancies in terms of their approach to interviews. We found that there were discrepancies in their approach to hiring in general. And so different folks were being asked different questions that
really?
Wasn't necessarily outlined in the same way. And so one of the things that we worked with them on was actually establishing this rubric where they're answering questions ahead of time, right? And you're putting this in a format that then made the process much more equitable. And we found that organization where they were, what was the percentage?
So, you know, once we implemented this, we sort of ran our pilot through mm-hmm. And we increased their diverse candidates by 300%.
Yeah.
And they were able to tap into new markets, which meant, you know, new business,
right.
new contacts, new partnerships. So ultimately, you know, all of that works out well.
Absolutely.
Wow. It's a fascinating element to this, for sure. We're talking this morning with Akua Menz Adu and also Kim LaVere from the Clementine Gold Group. We brought you in to talk about Project 2025. Mm-hmm. I'm interested. I'll let you take this where you want. You know, we talk about the benefits of DEI, and now we're seeing kind of this backlash, mm-hmm. a backlash that now with Project 25 has almost gone to a whole new level. Just a glance through it, you know, well written, well documented piece of report. But from your perspective, where is it being generated from? Is it just a political maneuver to try to capture a certain, you know, voting percentage all across the country, or is it coming from someplace that's, you know, maybe a little bit more of the traditional part of America that is not always the best part of America?
Yeah, I think you're saying it exactly right in your latter statement, because one of the things that we're finding is that you know, we're becoming a plurality nation, and that means that we're not going to have a single ethnic or racial majority in this country. And it's already happening in larger cities. The city of Buffalo, for instance, is 53% people of color and 47% white. And so that's due to the increase in new Americans that are coming into our community. And we find that when you have new Americans, they're hardworking, right? They want to, you know, promote growth within a community and society. And when you read this Project 2025, you're seeing that they're trying to reverse a lot of that's already happening, right? It's going to continue to happen. Maybe this will delay some of that growth and opportunity, but I think that a lot of what Project 2025 is saying is relating to, you know, reversing some of the work that has been done around DEI efforts. And so relating to gender, sexuality, and race, and it aims to end most of the federal government's efforts to achieve equity and mostly collect data that could be used to track outcomes across both public and private sectors. And so when you do that, you lose the ability to even track that progress in general, right? And I know Kim and I talk about that often, the SOGI data and how important that is for progress.
Right. But in terms of like who this is sort of targeted to, I think it's targeted towards people who think they're left behind sort of the DEI movement. You know, I think there's such a focus on sort of, you know, leveling the playing field that some folks who have previously benefited feel as though there's not a place for them. But I think that, you know, for DEI to really work, everyone has to be a part of it. Like, we all have to work together to, you know, sort of move the needle on all of those goals.
It's interesting to say, talk about people who have benefited from it, but there's also fairly significant, it seems to me, backers of what, in essence, Project 2025 might appeal to, of people who really aren't benefiting from the current playing field, even though they might be white, you know, rural, whatever. What do you make of that? I'm wondering. Again, I'm throwing out some different things here, but I think we have a good conversation kind of going on here about you know, two different sides of this that really need to, you know, find a way to move forward.
Yeah, I think when you hear that, right, like those folks that you're mentioning, and, you know, they might be white, but when I think about it from a socioeconomic standpoint, you know, they're not necessarily benefiting from the current state of affairs either. And so they probably have a lot more in common with the folks that this Project 2025 is aiming to, I don't want to say like get rid of, but silence. Right. Mm-hmm. And so I think that's one of the biggest things that this country has seen, is when you get folks who can connect on that level, it makes it that much more of a powerful movement. And that's something that would not benefit those who are already at the top. Right. And that's the overarching conversation, I think, that connects those two groups together.
Yeah, I think, you know, the focus on villainizing DEI has really focused on trying to other groups. And that sort of siloing and that fear-based rhetoric is really pushing, I think, all of these responses, right? Because I think that we do have more in common with each other than there are differences.
Right.
And it is another part of it also. I mean, there's so much to get into here, but in essence, demonizing the people who identify in a non-binary gender. That is another thing that, again, talk about silence. That, when you read it in a certain context, that almost feels like you said, an almost erasure of people who have identified in a certain way.
Yeah, to me that feels like some of the most dangerous language, because I know, you know, we have friends who identify, you know, along the spectrum for gender expression and identity, mm-hmm. and just thinking about how hard they've worked to, you know, be recognized, to get benefits, mm-hmm. to, you know, just be able to live. It just sort of feels as though Project 2025 is trying to decide who is looked at as human and Absolutely. Who is not.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah.
And that feels really dangerous.
Yeah, it does. And I would say that, you know, in the context of Project 2025, their aim is to take the following terms out of every rule and regulation. And so we talk about SOGI data in the healthcare space where we both come from previously. It is something that we rely on to make decisions, right? When you're able to disaggregate data to that extent, you can then see who's being left behind, whose outcomes aren't the greatest, right? And those are things that in healthcare and other sectors, we depend on to make decisions around things like resources and just where we need to put more efforts in. And so the Project 2025, it says that they need to take out terms of every rule and regulation. And that includes SOGI, so sexual orientation and gender identity, DEI, gender identity, gender equity, gender awareness, gender sensitive, abortion, reproductive rights, reproductive health and reproductive rights. And so if you get rid of all those terms and we can't take note of, you know, where people fall in line in that spectrum, then what does that mean? It means that people who are already marginalized become even further marginalized mm-hmm. and disenfranchised by our current systems that were built, you know, by people who might have different biases, right? And so we've made so much effort to be able to find those different pockets so that we can rightfully put things together in order to make them better, right?
What do you see inside that data that you'd have access to right now?
What
are the things that you might think are, you know, kind of hidden elements mm-hmm. that really need to be highlighted when it comes to understanding, you know, how current policies or how traditional policies have impacted people, like you said, that are marginalized? What are we seeing?
Yeah, I think, you know, a great example of that is something that we all recently went through, right, which is the COVID, you know, pandemic. Mm. And so when I think about it from a healthcare standpoint, we know that folks who are already marginalized had a harder time and the death rates were a lot higher for those folks than it was for folks that might not have been in that situation, right? And so when we looked at the data, especially coming from the healthcare organization we were working in, we found that there were certain communities that suffered more. When we looked at 14215, which is predominantly East Side, you know, community, they had higher rates than the other folks that we were servicing in that specific space. And so if you can't say that, you know, these things are happening, then you can't put something in place to really make sure that those folks are getting more support and help, right? It doesn't make sense to use limited resources for folks that don't necessarily need it. And so when you're able to disaggregate and find that there's certain pockets within communities that are suffering more, then you put resources behind those that need it the most, you know?
Absolutely. It's interesting to hear it phrased in that regard, because mm-hmm. It seems almost, after, you know, it's something now that this element of Project 2025 is talking about kind of eliminating something that we've all become very accustomed to and very comfortable with, identifying ourselves in certain ways.
Yeah. Yep.
It's a odd development in terms of that. I mean, I always keep wanting to kind of come back into, like, from where does that really stem? Is it, like you said, just you really feel it's kind of coming from this kind of dark place that just says, we want to just, people who are marginalized already, that's fine.
Yeah.
Let's keep it going.
I think, you know, one of our values as a company is from the margin to the center.
Okay.
And that's because there's many voices and people that don't get the rightful attention that they need to thrive and have a prosperous life, right? I think when we have this notion of what the American dream is that everyone has access to, you know, affordable healthcare, they have access to a house, right, that they can live in. You can thrive in these conditions, right? You're making enough money, you have education, you have access to all these things. Because when we look at it, you know, we can tell that if based on your zip code, we can tell your life expectancy. And why is that? Right. You know, healthcare is only 20% of someone's overall health. All the others come from social and environmental positions that we all face. So if I can say, because I live in the zip code, you know, my life won't get to thrive as someone else who lives in a different zip code, that's a real issue there, right? But when you start to take away some of that, then what does that mean? That those folks that are on the margins, they don't have the same, you know, space to really thrive in life. And so I don't know where, you know, this originates from, but we know that people create systems and they design systems. Bias is baked into everything that we do because we all have bias, right? And so when you start to diminish the opportunities for that to be at the forefront, that means that those folks who are already struggling will continue to struggle. And who's benefiting from that? I think that's the question that, you know, you can answer and deduce from who's designing it, right?
Yeah. Interesting part, some of the reporting about Project 2025, but basically, a core of it is that DEI is being characterized as a violation of anti-discrimination laws. What do you make of that? I mean, when you talk about discrimination in this country, and to suggest that finding ways to be more equitable is discriminatory.
Well, I can think of a prime example, and this is something that we've been following in the DEI space. And I don't know if you've heard of the Fearless Fund, but it's a fund that was created by two Black women in the Atlanta area. And they were really trying to put opportunities together for businesses that were created by, you know, folks of color. And so they had this grant program where they were giving $20,000 to, I think it was female, Black female founders, because we know that venture capital, they get less than 1% of venture capital in the country. And so they were creating this fund to really, you know, basically like be that bootstrap arm, friends and family arm of funds that go out to those businesses. And Edward Blum, who was a conservative activist who went after affirmative action at the education level, was now trying to attack it at this level. And so one of the things that we've seen is that when you attack that, they were trying to make a precedent across the country where race-based, you know, race-based concepts were now being pushed back. And so if you can do it at that level, then you can make sure that race-based isn't being included in a lot of different areas. And there's a lot of organizations, foundations and alike, who are now trying to revert back from that because, you know, there's this fear around getting in trouble because the Supreme Court has now made this case, right? You know, I think there's a lot of things that we have to take into consideration as it relates to race, but you have folks who are now trying to turn this into something else, right? They're using the Civil Rights Act to say that now you're discriminating against other folks, when in reality it was put in place because there's such a disparate, you know, outcome already that's happening in the country based on our systems.
Right. And it's also based on history. But I think, you know, the more that we fight against having any sort of history taught in schools, and, you know, Project 2025 specifically says that, you know, there will be no further discussions about any of that. And, you know, there's sort of that quote, like, you're doomed to repeat history if you don't learn about it. And I think that this is one of those examples, like going after this, not thinking about
how we got here in the first place,
here in the first place, and also the real landscape, the real opportunities, the real deficit of like network gap and, you know, things like that.
And the network gap is something, it's the same thing, right? We can tell someone's success based on their zip codes. You know, we often talk about your success being those folks that are around you, like the, you know, five or six most people that you're around. But we can determine that if you're in a zip code where there aren't that many successful people, you're doomed to be in that same category, right? And so what we also find around the data is if you don't measure it, it doesn't matter. And you can't take that into consideration. And so one of the things that Project 2025 aims to do is to get rid of the collection of all this data at the federal level, all these different institutions. And if you're not measuring it, it doesn't matter. And you can't, you know, fix it. You can't center that in the conversation.
And for some organizations, that federal measurement, you know, the EEO-1 data is the only thing that they use to measure. So all of a sudden, the ways that you're measuring, you know, your hiring, your promotions, your onboarding and offboarding, if there's no data, you can just say you're doing great.
And it talks about that, right? It says at the CDC level, Project 2025 wants to reverse them from even collecting that data. And so think about that. We just had a pandemic. if we weren't able to look at the data and see who was dying at higher rates and what was happening around that, we couldn't really target those communities with preventative measures and, you know, things like the vaccination, right? Like, so those are the types of things that this would aim to end, which just means that, like I said, the folks that are already marginalized will continue to fall further and further behind.
We are talking about Project 2025 this morning on What's Next with two individuals who've given it some thought. With us, we have Akua Menz-Adu and also Kim LeVere of the Clementine Gold Group. We're going to take a time out on What's Next and come back with more. This is WBFO.
At Buffalo Toronto Public Media, community is at the heart of everything we do. Whether we're dancing alongside you at Porch Fest, inviting you in for a tough conversation about systemic racism, teaching you about what to do when someone overdoses, or entertaining you with free concerts in our performance space. Engaging with and serving our community is our top priority. This is Public Media.
Hi there. Thank you for listening to WBFO, your NPR station. It's our annual membership pledge drive right now, and we're taking an important moment to ask you to become a sustaining member of Buffalo Toronto Public Media, your community radio news station. Being a sustainer means that you are a crucial, ongoing monthly contributing member of our family. Donate online now at WBFO.org or call 1-877-456-8870.
You're listening to What's Next, our place to discuss the important issues of our communities of Western New York and Southern Ontario. We want to hear from you. Click on the Talk to Us option in the WBFO app, and we will work to get your questions or comments on the air. Do you have a story or concern that we should be addressing? Email us using whatsnext@wbfo.org. Together, we'll have the conversations that are needed. This is WBFO, your NPR station.
And welcome back to What's Next. We're talking with Akua Menz-Adu and also Kim LeVere. Kim is the managing director of Clementine Gold Group, and Akua is the founder and also the president of it as well. Their focus is on DEI, and we are focusing on Project 2025. We've touched on some different elements of this as well. Akua, you mentioned, of course, healthcare and how the need for data that Project 2025 basically promotes changing in the federal government and just basically eliminating that data. What about from an education standpoint? I think Project 2025 wants to eliminate the Department of Education just to start, but also what can be taught? And this is a debate that's been going on now for some time about what can be taught in schools, and some states have made their own way. You know, what do you see when it comes to that type of subject?
Yeah, I think the other notion under Project 2025 is to also dismantle Title IX. And so Title IX was a federal civil rights law in the U.S., and it was enacted a part of the Education Amendment in 1972. And it really prohibited discrimination based on sex in any educational program or activity receiving federal financial assistance. And so the aims around Project 2025 is also to roll that back as well.
You know, it's interesting you mentioned Title IX, because under Title IX, if I understand it, basically has made women's sports in colleges or any federally funded college or college has made those programs, they had to be funded on the same level
exactly
as men's.
Yep.
And it's interesting that we're at this time now that we have seen now an explosion of women's sports.
Absolutely.
And think about, I mean, again, I was 10, I think, when Title IX came out. But, you know, the idea that the complaints at the time were, well, this is just a waste of funds. Why are we doing this? You know, and I won't get into some of the other things that we probably heard over the times. But just to reflect on that idea that, look at all of a sudden, there's a huge market
absolutely
for women's sports.
Absolutely.
And 50 years ago, nobody believed that was going to be the case.
Right, right. I mean, look at the WNBA, for instance. I know a lot of folks have been paying attention to that, but there's an expansion of teams that are happening now across the country and Canada as well. And so there are folks who are obviously interested. It's been an exciting time to watch. I mean, you're seeing star players, these rookie players that are coming in and elevating the level of the game as well, which has been really cool. But, you know, I'm a former athlete at University at Buffalo. Buffalo. And so I remember, you know, you have a football team that is made up of all men, and they're getting a lot of money and funds and scholarships. Title IX was something that definitely deepened the opportunity around sports for women. And we saw other opportunities, right? We're getting different grants and different scholarships now because of that ruling and what that looked like over time. And so, you know, one of the things is in Title IX is around like sexual discrimination, right? And so it aimed to eliminate gender-based discrimination, ensuring that no one is denied participation or benefiting from educational programs. And so to roll that back means that we're rolling all the progress that happened with that back as well. And so I think there's a lot of things that we have to consider as it relates to that.
And it also shows, I would like to thank, you know, kind of getting back to part of this conversation we had at the start, mm-hmm. that it shows you the possibility, I shouldn't probably give it a label, but of a progressive initiative from 50 years ago
yeah.
that has
yes.
has benefited everybody in society and has really changed the look of society.
Right.
And it seems, again, not to overcharacterize, but Project 2025 kind of seems to me, it looks to kind of roll back mm-hmm. some of that progress mm-hmm. and maybe stunt progress that has been made.
Yeah. Another area under Title IX that, you know, Project 2025 would eliminate is the sexual harassment and violence component of that. Mm. And so it addresses sexual harassment and violence within educational institutions as well. And so schools had to respond now to prevent incidents of sexual misconduct, creating safer environments for students as well. And so when I think about athletics even, right? Think about yeah. the U.S. gymnasts that just went through this really large case around some of the, you know, misconduct that was happening there. This wouldn't be addressed, right? Based on what Project 2025 aims to do.
Yeah. Let's talk about your company a little bit and how, mm-hmm. what now maybe you're seeing. I'll try to generalize and I'll allow you
yeah.
to pare it down for me. You know, DEI, there was a push that came in the last couple of years mm-hmm. for companies were embracing it. Now we're hearing that companies aren't so much. Mm-hmm. Is that, are you seeing that yourselves? You're seeing that?
I think so. I mean, there's a balance of what we're seeing that's happening. There's some folks who are getting even stronger in this work, right? And so our organization, we're an equity-centered strategy and planning firm. And so equity is baked into the work in terms of how we approach our work. One of the things that we've seen is that there's some folks that through the fear of things that are happening at the Supreme Court level with the education case are now backing away. They're trying to change terms. So instead of using race-oriented data or sexual orientation and things like that, they're looking at it from more of a socioeconomic standpoint mm-hmm. To really call out the same groups that they meant to go after in the first place who are being left behind. And so there's some folks who are saying, you know what, we're just going to maybe rename it and call it something different with the same aims that it was meant to do. And there's other folks who are saying, you know what, we're going to back away altogether and maybe, you know, put this in back into human resources responsibility, right? And so I think there's a balance of what we're seeing, but there's a lot of folks who are saying, no, we intended to do this work and we're going to continue to do it.
Yeah, that's encouraging to see that.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I don't know, Kim, if you have any other thoughts on that.
No, I think I agree. I think we've sort of seen both of those, mm-hmm, right? Mm-hmm. So some folks change it to belonging or culture, mm-hmm. you know, they sort of go that route, like it's a corporate culture thing, or they're doubling down, knowing that they may face some scrutiny down the line.
Right, right.
Just for you who are joining us right now, we are talking about Project 2025. It's an over 900-page document from the Heritage Foundation. It has been associated and linked to a certain extent with the Trump Vance ticket, mm-hmm. though we can't have to mention that they have in some ways distanced themselves from it. But to keep in mind that 31 of the 38 authors of Project 2025 were advisors in the Trump mm-hmm. administration. So that's a key part of this as well. Do you find that surprising to see the Trump ticket try to maybe distance itself from?
I mean, I don't think so, because it's become this political talking point, right? And so there's a lot of folks who are saying, oh my gosh, you know, you need to read Project 2025 and what it stands for. I know that they were also giving different conservatives and Republicans scores as it related to their specific agenda through the Heritage Foundation. And J.D. Vance actually had a score of 93%, a lifetime score from the Heritage Action for America, whereas Republicans' average were around 61%, right? And so you have someone who is being touted as, oh my gosh, they're going to be someone who follows our plans forward, and this is the plan of action for the first 100 days for when that conservative president comes into position and play in the U.S. And so I'm not surprised that people are moving away from it, because it's become this political talking point to say, hey, this is what they really intend to do. But at the same time, people do need to recognize what this looks like, because there's been measures in the past that have been passed by conservatives in that way. Actually, J.D. Vance, as a senator in Ohio, was someone who recommended rolling back DEI at the federal level. So this is something that has already taken place. He co-sponsored a bill to do that. And so we're not surprised. We just have to be ready and position ourselves for the backlash that it might cause.
I know in some quarters there's a let's not talk about politics.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
Right? Let's not talk about politics. Yep. But I'm kind of curious about maybe just, you know, you two have your business interests and, and such. Are you hearing political conversations, and are you hearing anybody talking about Project 2025?
I think given that this is an election year, it's really hard to
It's hard to mute it, right?
But have any conversations.
But it's pretty intense when it does emerge, right?
I would say most of our clients at this point have had some sort of political conversation with us, you know, sort of feeling things out or sort of asking more questions about different areas. And we just try to provide the information.
Yeah, I think, you know, to the point of if this data collection is now not taking place, like what are the what then do you do? Right. Mm-hmm. Because a lot of organizations rely on this data to make informed decisions on what they should do in terms of their operations. And so I think a lot of the conversation has been from a preventative standpoint of, hey, we got to be prepared, you know, with these two different situations. Right. If there is a progressive president, then we got to follow this line of thought. If there's a conservative, you know, president, we got to follow this line of thought. And so I would say besides that, as it relates to, you know, how an organization operates, there's a lot of conflicts that are happening within organizations as well. And one of the things that we found, we do managerial trainings, right? And so leadership development trainings and really preparing the leaders for the future of what's to happen. And the politics don't stop once you enter the four walls of the workplace.
Right.
So a lot of conflict we're seeing happening within the workplace is because people have different ideologies and, you know, are maybe struggling to operate in a sense of civility within organizations. And so we find that not only is it from an operations standpoint, it's also a day-to-day in terms of interactions and the culture that really makes up the workplace as well.
I really appreciate your ability to kind of take us inside those conversations.
Yeah, yeah.
It's really interesting. I'm also wondering, though, is there a concern that something like Project 2025 might be working to normalize a certain attitude in this country? I'm wondering if you sense that. I mean, and as we think about it, like even the fact that we have to talk about it because it's something that does align with the points of view of one of the major party tickets. But I'm just wondering if there's a thought about that as well, because obviously, I mean, you guys have a lot of deep thoughts when it comes to this issue.
I mean, I think the other piece that we have to recognize is that folks do have these thoughts, right? And so when we do this DEI work, you know, we're providing information and frameworks for folks to really be able to work sensibly together, right? Because like we said before, when organizations are more diverse, they're able to have larger profit margins because people are challenging each other with the best ideas. And so the reality is there's not, you know, a monolith in terms of how people think within organizations. And so you have to recognize that there are some folks who strongly will align themselves with something that's coming out of the Project 2025 playbook. What we recognize as practitioners is that the ability to have discussions has diminished dramatically in this country because of the polarization of what's happening across the country. There's folks that exist on every side of the coin, right? And we have to make sure that we're producing a workplace and atmosphere where people can work across differences. I think that's one of the major things.
Yeah, I think, again, you know, you can't say that you believe in belonging mm-hmm. and you exclude an entire group just because you don't like what they think.
Exactly.
It's the same no matter how you look
exactly.
at it.
Exactly.
You know, we've been talking a lot about not only conflict resolution, but the idea that, you know, someone can have an opinion, mm-hmm. but, you know, ultimately, you know, for an organization, you know, tying things to your values mm-hmm. and how you operate is the best way to go. Knowing that the individual employees can feel a lot of different ways mm-hmm. about whatever may be going on at any time. I think right now, you know, with 24-hour news, social media, all of those things, we're all getting a lot of information a lot of the time.
Right.
Maybe in a way that we shouldn't. But, you know, people come in, there's a lot of things that they're dealing with, a lot of feelings, a lot of thoughts about things, and people clash.
Yeah.
So, you know, navigating how you can create belonging, knowing that not everyone is going to think the same thing.
Exactly.
We don't believe in that.
Yeah, and we can't, right? Because, you know, I think a lot of folks think that this work is around changing hearts and minds, but how we look at it from an organizational standpoint is really navigating around behaviors, a set of behaviors. Mm. And so tying behaviors to those values. What does it mean to have a respectable workplace, right? That means that when I come into the workplace, I'm going to greet everyone. I'm going to say hello. I'm going to be pleasant in terms of my exchanges. It doesn't mean that, oh, you have to believe this or believe that, right? And so navigating that to a point of what behaviors look like and what behaviors are deemed acceptable and not acceptable is really the stemming of the work that we're doing at this point in time, right? We're not trying to change those hearts and minds, but we are trying to regulate how your behaviors are working in the workplace.
That's really interesting.
Yeah.
Not trying to change hearts and minds, but trying to make it work
in
the workplace.
Exactly.
We've got another time out here. We're going to come back and finish our conversation, and it's been a good one today with Kim LaVere, Managing Director of the Clementine Gold Group and its founder and President, Ekua Menzedu. This is What's Next on WBFO.
Ever think about state government and just get totally lost? Well, I'm Corey, and this is Compact Civics, so of course I got your back. First, let's look at the four key officers elected by the people in New York State. The governor leads the executive department. The lieutenant governor is elected on a joint ballot with the governor. The state comptroller is in charge of the Department of Audit and Control, and the attorney general heads the Department of Law. Then there are the heads of state departments and agencies. This is a long list, but what you need to know is that they're all in the executive branch and most are appointed by a governor. But the notable exceptions are commissioners and chancellors of education, which are all appointed by a board. The state legislature is bicameral, which means there's an upper and lower chamber. In New York, it's called the Assembly and the Senate. And for local governments, New York State is divided into 62 counties, which include the five boroughs of New York City. All these local governments have the power to adopt local laws that align with the state constitution and general laws. Yeah, New York government can seem complex, but what do you expect from a state with nearly 20 million people?
Special thanks to our partners, the Buffalo Presidential Center, whose mission is to explore and share stories about Buffalo and Western New York's contributions to the U.S. presidency and national affairs.
You're listening to What's Next, our place to discuss the important issues of our communities of Western New York and Southern Ontario. We want to hear from you. Click on the Talk to Us option in the WBFO app, and we will work to get your questions or comments on the air. Do you have a story or concern that we should be addressing? Email us using whatsnext@wbfo.org. Together, we'll have the conversations that are needed. This is WBFO, your NPR station.
And welcome back to What's Next. With us, Ekua Menzedu, president and founder of Clementine Gold Group. Kim LaVere is the managing director, having a conversation here that's built so much around talking about Project 2025. Most certainly would encourage people to research it a little bit more and also perhaps maybe even take a look at the original document. It's I will say it is a well-sourced document for sure, but really twists around a lot of what I think has been common language in society for a while. And well, I'll let other people make their judgments on it than have me take it. But it just, I wanted to maybe get into a conversation here about when it comes to just the idea that we're only so far when it comes to race in this country. Mm-hmm. And to see a document like this become so embedded in the political sphere and almost to a certain extent, maybe normalizing a certain stance. Mm-hmm. How troubling, I guess, for lack of a better term, is that for you or for mm-hmm. people that you know?
Yeah, I mean, let's be honest. A lot of the work that we do, we look at it from an extension of folks who came before us, right? This has been a fight in this country since its inception, I think, right? And this is work that needs to continue to happen so that folks can live a prosperous and thriving life. And so by diminishing the conversation around things like race, you know, we only diminish the progress that has continued to happen over, you know, centuries at this point, right? And so I think one of the things that we have to continue to do is have the conversation, continue to get more comfortable around the conversation, because a lot of folks already have a fear around having the conversation to begin with, right? And so setting that tone in place where it becomes just another thing that we're talking about is some of the work that we do on an everyday basis, but it's also something that's being targeted by the fear around things like this.
Right. And I think, you know, bringing Project 2025 back into it, just thinking that, you know, they're going after any sort of classroom discussions mm-hmm. around mm-hmm. race, gender, systemic oppression. But I think that the more that we attack those types of conversations and that type of information, it just makes for uncomfortable adults to ever have that conversation. Yeah. You know, I think there is some reconciliation that we need to have around our history and sort of how we came up and how we sort of move forward as a country. Mm-hmm. And we can't do that if we never talk about what transpired before us.
Exactly. Exactly. And I mean, I'm Ghanaian, right? And one of the terms that we use is Sankofa, which means to, you know, look back in order to move forward, right? And so you can't go forward if you don't look back. And so to Kim's point, you know, she has two young children, and these conversations are things that they're having in school, right? Or there's bumps and ruptures that are happening in schools that we've even had happen to us, right? And so if this continues in a way where we can't talk about this, or we're removing the possibility to talk about this in the not only the workplace, but also in schools, what does that mean for us as adults? And I think that poses a really large question, right? It produces more uncomfortable adults who then don't have the conversations, and the ruptures continue to happen in the workplace and in our society altogether.
You know, well, I don't think we've made any mention of it, but it does show itself in Project 2025 is definitely a backlash against critical race theory. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Let's maybe turn this on its head for just a second. And in talking about why that is important to mm-hmm. be taught. Again, I guess we kind of just got into it a little bit here, but, you know, it's something, it very quickly turned into this hot button issue. It went from being something that people were kind of talking about and exploring to all of a sudden, it's something, you know, I mean, the state of Florida basically went out of its way to ban it from the classroom.
Yeah, I think that's another one of those terms, though, that gets co-opted.
Right, exactly.
Because elementary students are not learning critical race theory, right? You know, high school students are not learning critical mm-hmm, race mm-hmm. theory. We're just talking about learning basic U.S. history. I think that critical race theory was a really hot item for a while there was a lot of confusion about what it was.
Right.
And I think the more that folks worked to define it and to sort of say, actually, it's not taught until like, you know, upper college level or graduate level and those sorts of applications, that we were like, oh, and it became less of a concern. But now just sort of talking about any education around that, you know, is the issue.
And I always find myself like asking folks who, you know, might have strong opinions around things like this, what is it? What does it mean to you, right? Because oftentimes we think there's a shared language that is happening around some of these terms, but there really isn't. So what is critical race theory, right? And I bet a lot of folks would struggle to even define it, right? It came out of the 1970s, and it was really trying to push this sense of what traditional civil rights was happening, the approach to civil rights to address systemic racism in general, right? And so CRT, it was arguing that racism is not just a product of individual bias or prejudice, but it was embedded in legal systems, policies, and social institutions. And we know that that's the case, right? Like a lot of these things that are happening, you know, for instance, there's a big conversation around transportation right now. And you think about urban renewal and what that did. It drove highways in the middle of different neighborhoods and it prevented these neighborhoods from growing and prospering, right? So when you think about the notion of what happens after that, now we have a larger context to talk about. Environmental racism that happens where there's certain communities that we're looking at cancer clusters. It's happening higher in these communities because of their proximity to hazardous waste that might have been dumped in their yards, right? These are things that a lot of these issues are targeting and trying to address ultimately.
How do you address that? I have to believe that critical race theory has come up in these many conversations you've had in these organizations that you go to. How do you work around that? Just what you kind of did there, right? The idea that it's highly misunderstood. Mm-hmm. I mean, how do you do it?
I would say it doesn't come up as often as you would think at this point, but really just addressing like what it really is and sort of understanding the difference between, you know, regular U.S. history and sort of those applications around systemic concerns and systems change. Because I think that most adults can say that some part of the system, you know, the larger,
right,
the system in quotes,
right,
is broken or doesn't work the way that they think that it should. So there is some buy-in there.
For sure. Yeah. And I think, you know, like I said, a lot of it we just see from folks not necessarily participating in the conversation. And so you can see the faces, right, where people are kind of sitting back in their chairs or, you know, and it's not like we're coming to this work and saying, oh my gosh, this type of person is bad and this type of person is good. It's really, let's have a conversation around history. Let's have a conversation around that history is now influencing how we work in the workplace now, right? What is acceptable? What's not acceptable? Who gets to really say that this is the way that things should be done and who doesn't, right? Whose opinions are included in conversations and whose aren't? And so I think a lot of this goes from this notion of what history has done and what it's produced to, hey, this is where we need to go and where we need to move as a society altogether.
Just interesting that you said you bring up history, take a look at history. Mm-hmm. Are there some key points that you'd like to point out about history when that conversation does emerge?
I think it really depends on the industry, right? Okay. And so we look at it from that standpoint. When we're working with healthcare organizations and they're trying to get into more marginalized communities, why can't you get folks to, you know, participate or actively, you know, engage in their own healthcare? And it's because there's things that have happened in society that might still limit people's their trust in the system altogether. When you can point at things like Henrietta Lacks, when you can point at things like the Tuskegee experiment, people have these thoughts at the top of their mind and it prevents them from wanting to trust in a system that has failed them in the past, right? And so it's important for us to know this so that we can approach it from a culturally, culturally humble point of view and a culturally a relevant point of view, right? Because there's some folks in society who have been disenfranchised and targeted in ways that history, you wouldn't know unless you knew about it, right? Or it's not something that's being taught. So we have to go back to understand why things are the way they are in order to address them now.
We've, I think, done a fairly good job of trying to keep this conversation from being too political.
Sure.
Right? I mean, it's hard to do because of its ramifications of Project 2025 and with which it's associated. But how about maybe a call to action of sorts here as we wind up our conversation about this is embedded in the campaign, the election campaign that's coming up in November. How about a call to action for what you would like to see from people moving forward? I'm not necessarily telling you who to vote for, but just how you might how to approach it. What do you say? What do you say?
I think, as with anything, do your own research and really just get out and vote. I think the biggest thing is that we think that our votes don't matter. So we just don't do it, right? Or we vote for, we have a write-in, you know, we have heard from some folks like, I'm going to write in my friend's name.
Right.
and I think, you know, the more that we can take that seriously and recognize that our votes do have power, that's the most important thing.
You know, I'm going to have that as the final word because we're out of time. Sorry about that, but thank you, Kim LaVere, for that. And Akua Menz Adu, thanks for being with us on What's Next.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
This has been What's Next on WBFO.
Support for WBFO and What's Next comes from our members and from Health Foundation for Western and Central New York, where racial and socioeconomic health equity are prioritized. Learn more about building healthier neighborhoods at hfwcny.org.